A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sen. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 29. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television. And today we are talking about The Nightmare Man. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. So, Nightmare Man starts on a remote Scottish island, which has been cut off by thick fog. And there has been a terrible and very mysterious murder.
And it's not just an ordinary murder, because the murderer appears to us not to be human. We see from the murderer's perspective, and we see a sort of distorted image and growling and all sorts of things. So we have this strange something that has committed a murder and will continue to murder. And the ordinary people of the island who are cut off by the fog must investigate this murder. And it proceeds from there.
So this was from the BBC again, and it was 4 30-minute episodes, so it's quite short and self-contained, and it came out in May 1981, and it's it combines features of science fiction, but also there's obviously there's horror, and as we've said, there's this murder mystery going on, and the precise identity of the murderer, and whether or not it's a human. So it's all very strange and quite gripping and quite spooky stuff.
Yes, it is. It was adapted from a novel called Child of Vaginoy, which came out in 1978. It was written by David Wiltshire, and it was a fairly small publication that came out in the UK at that time. It wasn't hugely popular, but it was used as the source for The Nightmare Man, this TV miniseries.
And the series was produced by, and as we'll hear as we go along, it's also starred many graduates from Doctor Who. And as we'll talk about, The Nightmare Man has a sort of a Doctor Who feel to it, without being obviously set in the Doctor Who world. But we'll hear about some of the science fiction elements as we go along, which sort of makes it suitable for discussion here on British Invaders.
Yes, there are quite a few characters involved here. The island is cut off, but there are quite a few people there, and we meet a number of them, including our central character, Michael Gaffigan, who was the island dentist, played by James Warwick, and he was a very clever man who was the island dentist, but he was also very interested in all the things that were happening around town, and he was a former military officer. He used to be a paratrooper, in fact, and his experience as a dentist and his experience from the military come into play and help the group of characters to ultimately solve the mystery.
And his romantic interest is a woman called Fiona Patterson, who's one of the locals on the island, and she runs the shop, and she's the sort of pharmacist, and she also, in her spare time, has a hobby of making maps, and she draws quite beautifully illustrated maps of the island. And so her hobby of making maps will come in quite useful as the series goes on, but also her skills as the pharmacist. And this was the time, obviously, before digital photography, so when people using cameras with film, the pictures were developed usually by the pharmacist. So she does that on the island, which is also will turn out to be quite significant. And she was played by Celia Imrie, who's a very well-known British character actress who we talked about a few episodes ago when she was in Gormenghast, and she's very good in the role and very good here.
Yes, this was roughly 20 years before she was in Gormenghast, in fact.
I think right at the very near the start of her career.
That would seem so. She was quite young in this. We also had Inspector Inskip, who was played by Maurice Rose. He was the police inspector who was the head of the local island and village police, and he came from elsewhere, not from the island, and this was a promotion that he got to be the head of a little police force, but it was in this very isolated place. So he does have some experience as an inspector, but he directs only a small force of about 4 or 6 policemen. And he does a lot towards the investigation, but he can't do it alone because he doesn't have the resources, and it is a little bit beyond him because he's just a regular police person, not an investigator who would know all of the things necessary for it.
But he's quite good at it. I mean, he's quite on the ball, isn't he? And he's well organized and quite resourceful. So he's going to be doing a lot of the detection work going on.
That's right.
And then we've got, as you said, we've got other characters who sort of like just going about their business on the island. And one of them is the island doctor, a chap called Dr. Gowdry, who was played by an actor called Tom Watson. He seems quite like the archetypal Scottish doctor in a way. He's got, you know, he's got the beard and the glasses, and you get the suspicion that he perhaps likes a wee dram. And he'll be involved in some of the grisly scenes that are going to come up and having to deal with the aftermath.
And then we have Colonel Howard, who is either retired British Army colonel, or as we find out later, he's actually an instructor, so he still is an Army colonel. And he is someone who comes onto the island just at the beginning of the story. He's there on a few days off as a tourist, but his presence is at some points an annoyance to the other characters and a complication, but also potentially he is a resource because of his military knowledge for solving the problems at hand.
And he's a bit of a mystery, isn't he?
Yes, he is. You're never quite sure what he's doing or why somehow.
Yes, and the locals and the police are a bit puzzled by him, and we're a bit puzzled by him as well. Although he's a very sort of respectable type gentleman with his absolutely perfect, you know, posh accent and everything. He's the English gentleman on holiday.
That's right. And we have a lot of other minor characters. You get the sense of having this little island community. And part of what I like about The Nightmare Man is you have basically a bunch of ordinary people solving this extraordinary mystery.
Yeah, and that works really well. I mean, as you say, it's ordinary people on an ordinary island, and you do get the sense that it's a very sort of typical community. And I think it helps that perhaps the actors, none of them were terribly recognizable. I think there wasn't a big star in there. So as we say, it's set on this isolated Scottish island in the Outer Hebrides, off the northwest of the Scottish coast, which I think the island is called Inverdy, or maybe that's the name of the town on the island. I'm not quite sure, but I think that's fictional. I think that's made up for the series.
The island was called Inverdy in the novel, and that was carried into the TV miniseries, but it was not mentioned very much at all, only in passing.
Ah, right. Okay, that would explain it. As I say, I think that was made up by Wiltshire, because there isn't really one of the islands in the Hebrides called Inverdy. We start the series, we do get this sort of feeling of this quite ordinary island, an ordinary community, and it's sort of winding down after its summer season. So you get the feeling that people are getting ready for a quite tough winter, and we sort of get the introduction, I think, of people going back to the mainland and just the locals getting ready to settle in for the winter.
Yes, that's right. You have that feeling. You also have the feeling of the fog settling, and after Colonel Howard comes onto the island, roughly, this fog settles and it basically cuts the island off and no one can come or leave. So there is almost a bit of the feeling of a country house mystery, that someone has committed a murder or something has committed a murder and no one can come or leave, so you know all of the people who are there.
We definitely get that sort of cut-off feeling, as you say, like a country house mystery, or even like a Hammer horror movie where some community is cut off by the fog and has to cope with some terrible horror in its midst. So it is a bit like that. And then we have, I think once we've met the sort of characters and we've sort of like had a quick trip around the island and seen some of the people coming and going, then really the story kicks off. And it kicks off on the golf course, of all places, when Michael Gaffigan, the dentist, is out playing golf by himself. Basically, on this more or less isolated golf course, he comes across a quite gruesome discovery.
And this is where murder is introduced to the story, because what he finds is the remains of a woman who has been murdered, and in a very brutal way, with pieces of the body dismembered, and quite an unpleasant thing. We don't actually see anything, but as we see from various characters' reaction, Gaffigan and others later, it was quite brutal indeed.
It's all very unpleasant, isn't it? I mean, I think they say at some point, one of the police gets told to bring the body back to the doctor for examination, and then they say something like, well, bring the bits that you found back, or something like that. So, as you say, it's all done by suggestion. We don't see a great deal of the gruesome detail.
That's right.
And the story really, is away and off and running. So we've got the investigation of this murder. We've got this community cut off from the mainland and not able to contact the authorities, the phones and radios aren't working completely reliably. So the inspector and his police force are on their own investigating. We've also got another character who we were introduced to at the very start of the story on the island. And there is a visiting Canadian scientist, Brian. One of your countrymen and colleagues is on the island.
That's right.
And he is camping out on a distant part of the island because he's an ornithologist. He's studying the local bird life, I believe. We get to see him return to his tent after having various cheerful conversations with Fiona Patterson and some of the other islanders. And we rather fear for him, don't we, Brian?
Yes, we do. And he features in the cliffhanger at the end of one of the episodes. And he has, shall we say, an unpleasant end. He is the second murder victim, and being an ornithologist and being there taking photos, he has a camera in hand when he's attacked. So there are some interesting things that fall out from that.
Well, as you say, at the end of the first episode, he is the cliffhanger because he's in his tent, he's recording on his tape recorder, and he has his camera handy, and it all goes rather unpleasantly wrong for him, and he becomes the second victim.
Yes, he does. And of course, the photos and the tape recorder become elements that show up in the story as we go along. There was also, shortly after the demise of the ornithologist, there was a sequence where they discover a large and unusual object that may be a vehicle or maybe something that potentially has alien origin or may come from somewhere unknown on Earth. It isn't clear where it comes from. But in addition to the strange, seemingly inhuman nature of the killer, we're also introduced to this strange object that may play into things somehow. That gives significant suggestion that maybe aliens are involved with this, or maybe something else is involved with this. So that gave you a science fiction element other than the killer itself.
That's right. We've got this. We've got these murders, which there are certain features which we'll get to, which suggest that the killer may not be human. And then we get this strange discovery, which suggests that there may be something not of this world involved. So it's all building up quite nicely with mystery and intrigue, and as you say, science fiction.
What's in the box?
Oh, this is what kept me up till three. It was Mrs. Anderson, by the way. This is a cast of the impressions I took.
Of her teeth?
Of a bite on her shoulder.
That's horrible.
So the teeth, believe me.
Can I see?
If you like. Now then. Normal human characteristics when viewed from the side, you see. But from the front, it's just this ridge in place of the upper incisors.
What on earth is it?
I don't know. I just hope it's something artificial.
What, you mean some kind of dental work?
I can't imagine anyone making an upper set like this, can you? The canines are definitely human. I wonder if it's possible that somebody here could be doing genetic experiments.
What, you mean creating...
So the production of Nightmare Man, it was produced by a chap called Ron Craddock, who was offered by the BBC this four-week, 30-minute slot before The Watershed. Now, that was 1981, so that's quite interesting in view of our discussions on a previous episode about the Omega Factor. Obviously, they had the concept of The Watershed then, and that would be, I think, significant when we talk about some of the details they used in the portraying the killings later on. So he was offered this slot, and then he then started to look around for something suitable to produce.
And he decided on two different novels that he thought were both interesting possibilities. And the story is that he gave both novels to his secretary, who read the two novels and decided that The Child of Agenoi was the better of the two novels, and that was the one that was produced.
And of course, the mystery is, what was the other novel? Because that's not recorded in history, is it?
I have no idea what the other novel may have been.
Yes, some unfortunate writer missed out.
I guess. Something that was kind of interesting that is quoted in the liner notes for the DVD is that when they requested licensing for the novel to be able to adapt it, they specifically said in the request that it would be done in such a way to reduce the level of sex and violence, essentially, that were in the novel, and that they would keep it so it would still be fairly accurate in terms of the story and the characters, but some of the motivations may change and some of the things you see may change in order to accommodate that. So the issue of the watershed, the idea that you could show violence and so on after a certain time in the evening, but beforehand you couldn't. That watershed concept was definitely something that was a part of the process here.
Right. So they had to tone the book down, I see. Having picked the book by David Wiltshire, or rather having had his secretary pick the book, Ron Craddock turned to Douglas Camfield to direct the series. And Douglas Camfield, who sadly is no longer with us because he died a few years after this, but he was, he's known to us in British Invaders because he directed some Doctor Who episodes, and he also directed some Blake 7. And I think he'd done some other genre stuff in on British TV as well, but particularly I think Blake 7 and Doctor Who. He had a reputation of being very well organised and running a very sort of disciplined production so that it would crack along quickly, and that would produce, was thought to produce quite tense, dramatic shows.
I think in Camfield's productions, you often ended up with something where they were not heavily edited when they went to actually air. They would just not have filmed that many things that would not be included in the final version.
Right.
We also had Robert Holmes as the writer to adapt the novel for television. And Robert Holmes is a name that is also very well known to us in British Invaders, also for Blake 7 and for Doctor Who, especially for Doctor Who. He was the script editor for Doctor Who in the mid-70s, and he wrote many, many stories for Doctor Who over a very long period of time. And he was very well known for writing good stories and having some scary components to his stories and having good solid stories, but making them quite scary. And this was something that he was very well known for and had a very good reputation for doing those kinds of things. In fact, nowadays, he is sometimes compared to Stephen Moffat, who is a writer for Doctor Who now and will be taking over as a producer for Doctor who also is known for interesting stories with these scary components. So this is the type of writer we were talking about with Robert Holmes, who is also no longer with us, but he continued to write for Doctor Who well into the 1980s.
And the comparison with Stephen Moffat is quite, in a way, it's quite flattering for both of them, isn't it? As you say, they both produce quite scary television. And this is, considering it's pre-Watershed, is actually quite scary television. And I actually found it more creepy than, say, something like The Omega Factor, which we've previously discussed on British Invaders.
Right. Yes, I can see why you would say that, because where The Omega Factor had tension in it and a lot of points to it, this had a current of tension that ran almost from beginning to end, and that was really nice.
Yeah. So they had to take the production team, and rather than taking them to the Outer Hebrides of Scotland itself, they, in fact, went almost completely the opposite direction, and went to the very southwest tip of England, to Cornwall. And the production crew went there in 1980, and they filmed not on an island, but on the coast of Cornwall, in around towns, I think Padstow, and I think some of it was filmed at a place called Port Isaac for some of the sequences. And they had to sort of give us the impression that this was on a remote, cut-off Scottish island.
That was something that they actually accomplished quite well. They used smoke guns and fog filters and all these things to get the idea that you were fogged in. And the types of locations and the bits of coastline that they used worked quite well. So you had a pretty convincing feeling that you were on not only an island, but a small island that had this village with maybe a few hundred people who lived on the island, if that.
Yeah, I mean, I was completely convinced that it was on an island, and only discovered about the Cornish connection when I read the liner notes, the production notes with the DVD. So they did it very well.
I think this was actually recorded either entirely on location or almost entirely on location. They used some indoor location shots as well, I believe. So it was really a heavy, heavy location use little series.
And it was on videotape, I think, rather than film.
Yes, it was. They did exterior videotape, which was unusual for the BBC at this time, for sure.
Right. And does that produce, do you think, a different look to it?
It does produce a slightly different look. And in this case, it gave you a look that worked quite well. It was crisp, but still had this feeling of being atmospheric and mysterious. So that was quite good. They handled that quite well.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting stuff.
I think the fact that they went out to do their location shooting, all of their shooting, almost at one shot, like they had a couple of different trips, but it was done in a pretty confined space of time. You were really looking at probably one or maybe two teams of people putting this together in terms of location shooting. So it gave you a quite consistent look, and they were able to do something nice with that.
Right, yeah. Okay, well, that will probably wrap up our discussion for the first part about Nightmare Man. Please come back and join us for the next episode when we continue our discussion. We'll be talking about yet more gruesome discoveries and more of the science fiction and horror elements that come into the story. And along the way, there's going to be some interesting twists in the tale. And we'll also talk a bit more about David Wilshire and the original book, Child of the Vaginoi, and how that was used to inspire this production.
I think we have some good stuff left to talk about.
Yeah.
You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. So until we finish our Nightmare Man discussion, this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And this is goodbye from Eamon in England.